Good morning. We'll get started promptly on time because that's the way we do things around here. My name is Charles Freeman. I hold the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS, no relation. Thanks, everybody, for coming. It's a good group here, and we're thrilled that many of you are here for what for some, even a few years ago, would have been a fairly, certainly esoteric, but somewhat fanciful notion that China would have a currency that would begin to be taken seriously as, if not a reserve currency perhaps, then certainly something that looks more international. I was at a conference a couple of years ago and asked the chief economist from Citibank whether the renminbi would ever be a reserve currency, and he literally guffawed and said, well, someone has to actually want to hold those things. Things have changed in the past couple of years. And we've got a pretty interesting group to talk about the international of the renminbi and what it means for the U.S. and others out here. What I'll do is we'll start. I'm going to introduce Melissa Murphy, who's a fellow here with the Freeman Chair, who's I've always considered her our secret weapon, but she's increasingly becoming less than a secret. She has been with CSIS for quite some time. Started with Phibis at State after school at these undistinguished institutions like Cambridge University and Harvard and the rest of it. She's going to hear and talk a little bit about a report that we've put out recently, which I hope you'll get a chance to look at about the internationalization of the renminbi. Then we're going to turn to people who know much more than Melissa and I do, in Peter Boutelier and Tim Adams. Peter really needs no introduction. He's here at SICE. I was talking to someone here who said I was a student of his. He was fantastic. And there she is, Anna Saito back there. So this is someone who remembers you well. I first heard of Peter during his time at the World Bank when he was in Beijing, but he's had a long and distinguished career at the bank before that, and I've even got information that at some point he was a chief economist for a Zambian energy firm, a state-owned copper company, so back in the day. Tim Adams also needs a little introduction. Tim is over at the Lindsay Group as a managing director there, but many of us got to know Tim from his time as Undersecretary of International at Treasury, where Tim did battle against the Chinese and other nefarious groups in the context of what was becoming the crisis, but really was instrumental in exchange rate policy, which became so controversial during the Bush administration, G7 meetings, IMF and World Bank issues. Tim, I got to know back. I actually interviewed with Tim for a job in 1999 when he was with the G7 group, and he very wisely turned my interest down. So we know that he's brighter than most of us. Before we go further, I wanted just to introduce somebody who was very instrumental in putting together the R report, and that's Wang Jinyuan from who's here at the Freeman Chair. Wenjin is actually Jean, as we like to call her, is at Maryland, but also came out of Fudan and is a terrific resource. And I hope that those of you that really want to understand what's happening in China get a chance to talk to Jean, because she is terrific on that score. So thank you, Jean, for all you do for us. Let me turn it over to Melissa Murphy.
Well, thank you, Charles. I'd just like to give a brief overview of the main findings and conclusions in our report before I pass it on to Charles and our distinguished panelists for the actual discussion. The reason we wrote this report was because we felt that there was far more heat than light in this discussion of China and the dollar. And what we've attempted to do in our report is give a clearer understanding of what China is actually doing, what its possible policy motivations are, where its policy might be headed, and what this implies for the United States. In the wake of the global financial crisis, much has been written about the extent to which the United States can continue to play its role as the world's predominant economic power, and whether the emerging BRIC economies, particularly China, are poised to challenge the current financial and economic architecture. And in recent months, speculation has really focused on the future of the US dollar, due largely to comments by senior Chinese officials that have led some commentators to conclude that the Chinese are ready to ditch the dollar and even usurp its role as the world's reserve currency with the renminbi. And although these sort of headlines make thrilling copy, we conclude that it would be a mistake to conclude that China is ready to ditch the dollar anytime soon, let alone supplant the dollar's reserve role with the renminbi. For one thing, Beijing has accumulated something like $1.4 trillion in U.S. dollar reserves and is keen to avoid any precipitous decline in the dollar's value, which would in turn devalue its own holdings. Beijing is unlikely to shoot itself in the foot. As for China's supposed designs to replace the dollar with the renminbi as a primary reserve currency, some commentators seem to be confusing three distinct concepts: currency internationalization, achieving reserve currency status, and being the dominant global reserve currency. It can take many decades for a currency to internationalize, and some currencies become internationalized without ever fully establishing themselves as reserve currencies, like the Swiss franc or even the Japanese yen. But nevertheless, as the largest holder of U.S. debt, Beijing is clearly nervous about the prospects of a weaker dollar and is taking steps to diversify its dollar reserves. As the initial effects of the financial crisis began to be felt, and clearly concerned about the policy risks associated with the U.S. dollar, the head of China's central bank published a series of articles calling for a new reserve currency system to be managed by the IMF. In March, Premier Wen Jiabao took the highly unusual step of declaring publicly that China was worried about its dollar reserves. And these signals from Beijing have been matched by action. Putting its money where its mouth is, China has begun to spend its dollars on overseas acquisitions and investments, especially in natural resource-related ventures, in an effort to shift its holdings to more stable long-term investments. In this vein, China has signed a series of deals with Russia, Brazil, and Ecuador to secure oil deliveries, and it's filling up its strategic petroleum reserves. Certainly, in doing so, China is publicly signaling its concerns about U.S. inflation and the weaker dollar to the Obama administration. China's tough stance also plays well to its domestic audience. It's put the spotlight on Washington as the main cause of the economic crisis and taken it off Beijing. And we go into more detail about the domestic context of China's policy in our report. Still, we note that these recent purchases only spent a fraction of China's dollar reserves. The bottom line is that given the interdependence between the U.S. and Chinese economic systems, as long as the United States remains China's number one export destination, Beijing will continue to accumulate U.S. dollars as fast as it can spend them. In the short to medium term, Beijing has little option but to continue to invest largely in U.S. debt instruments. Neither Europe nor Japan have bond markets deep enough to absorb China's investments. That is why, after a dip in April that set off alarm bells in currency markets worldwide, China's U.S. Treasury purchases subsequently picked up. Reports of the dollar's death thus proved premature. But that said, China has begun implementing a longer-term strategy to reduce its exposure to policy risk associated with U.S. dollar holdings. It's begun the protracted process of internationalizing the renminbi with the aim of assuming a principal role in directing the future of the international financial system. It's begun by launching a series of pilot schemes, expanding the use of the renminbi in the settlement of cross-border trade and international trade. And the most high-profile step has been the conclusion of six currency swap agreements during the summer. Turning the renminbi into a settlement currency is indeed the first in a series of steps towards internationalization of the currency. But again, we need to remember that this could take another decade before the renminbi could be eligible as a reserve currency, if it ever will. We know that China will have to come a series of obstacles before that happens, not least of which is making the currency fully convertible, and there is no clear timetable for that. China would also have to convince investors that its financial system is trustworthy and its economic system is stable over the long term. Chinese policymakers would also have to allow China to run a current account deficit to ensure an adequate supply of renminbi to satisfy global demand. And again, this is something that the Chinese government is far from prepared to do at this point. According to our sources, China's top leadership is currently very much on the same page with the initial steps that have been taken towards internationalization of the renminbi. But the content, scope, and pace of future renminbi internationalization remain very much up for debate. And again, we go into more detail about the debate going on in China amongst its economists right now, so you can take a look in the report. So conclusion, what does all this imply for the US dollar? As we know, perception is reality in volatile currency markets, and the dollar dips to new lows every time the Chinese bring up the issue of reserve currency. And that is why such knee-jerk reactions, we need to separate the rhetoric from the reality on this issue. As noted above, Beijing is readjusting its investment strategy in order to diversify its immense dollar reserves. It's begun the protracted process of internationalizing the renminbi and will continue to raise its international profile in pushing for reform of the global financial and economic architecture, and that will include reserve currency reform. But behind all these smoke and mirrors, the bottom line is that the United States remains the number one destination for Chinese exports, and as transactions will remain denominated in dollars, Beijing will continue to build up its dollar reserves. Given its vast holdings and current limited investment options, it has little choice but to continue to support the US dollar. Although then, in the short to medium term, the economic impact on the dollar will remain limited, we do conclude that the geopolitical sands are undoubtedly shifting. Beijing has put the world on notice that it is going to use its economic weight, its financial resources, and its growing geopolitical influence to ensure that Beijing and the other BRIC economies have a larger say in designing and operating any future international and economic system. So with that, I'll turn it over to Charles and our distinguished panelists and to get their views on this issue.
Let's ask. Thank you, Melissa. Let's ask Peter to speak to the broader issues and to drill down a bit, and then we'll turn it over to Tim to focus on the U.S. response.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you for including me in this panel. It's a subject that I've been fascinated by for some time and close to my professional interests. Let me start with my bottom line. I don't think we need to be negatively impressed by what's going on with the renminbi. And we should not be worried that the renminbi may become an international reserve currency. In fact, my concern is almost the reverse. I'm concerned that the Chinese will stop short of that, that they will promote the internationalization of the renminbi as a settlement currency, as a transaction currency, and they'll stop short of promoting its use as an international reserve currency. Why? Because the implications for China's domestic political system are pretty severe. If a currency is to serve as a reserve currency, like the dollar is at present the premier reserve currency, the state will have to retreat from controlling the economy very significantly. China's capital markets will have to become uncontrolled. Interest rate control will have to be given up. Is China ready for that? Is China ready, or is the Communist Party ready to retreat to a backroom role in China's economy? I doubt it. So that's my bottom line. Now some comments on this report, which I found very informative, very good. I have really only one criticism, if you might call it that. It doesn't go far enough. It observes correctly the facts as they are, but it doesn't really advocate a particular position for the U.S. to take. And I will elaborate on that. The financial crisis has undoubtedly promoted the search for alternative economic systems and promoted also discussion on reforming the international financial system, which since 71-73 has centered on the U.S. dollar as the centerpiece of the international reserve currency system. Is China really challenging the U.S. dollar? Yes, in some ways, of course, it is. But if the challenge is reflected in the papers presented by the governor of China's central bank on their website in March, I'm not worried about that challenge at all. I think that challenge was couched in very professional, careful words, non-threatening, non-political. It almost reminded me of the papers that were circulated at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. I mean, Zhou Jianshuan's proposal for the reform of the international currency is in many ways more similar to what Lord Keynes proposed in 1944 than any firebrand in the political system might say about the U.S. dollar. It's a very carefully worded, very professional proposal, and very, very constructive, I think. Zhou Jianshuan recognizes that his proposal cannot be implemented anytime soon, if it is at all implemented in its form as proposed. He recognizes it will take decades to reform the international financial system. Is that really, therefore, a challenge to the U.S. dollar? I think, and we should also realize that he is not alone. The concerns about the current international financial system are not uniquely Chinese. They're pretty much international. Even strong U.S. allies, Germany, have expressed very similar concerns. The Brazilians, if anything, are more vocal in their criticism of the system than even the Chinese, and so are the Russians. But I think the Chinese, if anything, have been more constructive than some of the other critics. So I had some questions about the title, because I don't quite see it that way. I think China's proposals are much more positive and constructive than most people thought they were at the time they came out. The knee-jerk reaction at the political level in the U.S. was not really quite unwarranted by the proposal itself. Is there that much distrust in the U.S. dollar currently? That's an interesting question, because you would think that the whole world is now turning its back on the U.S. dollar. The evidence is not there. China and other major holders of international reserves continue to invest in dollars. They do nothing to undermine the dollar. Certainly China isn't at present, to my knowledge. So how strong is that distrust? One important little indicator to look at is the market pricing of the TIPS, that is the inflation-adjusted treasuries. You can buy inflation-adjusted treasuries. If that's your preference, you pay a premium, obviously. And you would expect, if there were a widespread distrust of the future of the U.S. dollar, that the market for TIPS would balloon. It hasn't happened. Premiums have remained low. So what's all this fuss about? The markets do not indicate that, in spite of the declining international value of the dollar, that there is any massive distrust emerging. So let me just come back to where I started, my bottom line. I'm of the opinion that it would actually be a U.S. interest to support what's going on for two reasons. What's going on in China's currency system, starting with the promotion of the international use of the Chinese currency as a settlement, as a billing currency, as a transaction currency. That's a good thing, assuming that it will lead to the next step, namely the graduation into reserve currency status of the renminbi, of which I am not sure, as I mentioned. The internationalization of the renminbi is going on anyway. It was already going on before the government made it a policy. Already for 10 years, the renminbi had been circulating in border areas in eastern Russia, in northern Thailand, Vietnam, and in certain parts of Central Asia, simply for convenience. There was no policy behind it. The Chinese government didn't promote it, didn't try to stop it. It simply happened because it was so convenient to use the renminbi. And that is, incidentally, also, I believe, one of the reasons why the Chinese were keen to maintain a fixed bank with the U.S. dollar, because that made it so much easier to use the renminbi. You could be relatively sure that the dollar-renminbi exchange rate was not going to do any wild things. Only last year did they begin to explicitly and actively promote the internationalization of the renminbi in the form of bilateral swap, local currency swap agreements with six countries. And now there is talk with Brazil and with Russia to go beyond that and to create a system in which the importers in China can actually pay the exporters in Russia or in Brazil in renminbi, and vice versa, that the Brazilian importers of goods from China can pay in real. That goes beyond the local currency swap agreement. That, to my knowledge, hasn't really been worked out. I don't think anybody knows how you administratively can safely do that. But that's on the cards. If all these initiatives lead to the greater international use of the renminbi as a reserve currency, so be it. Power to them. I think it is ultimately not a U.S. interest to protect and preserve the current status of the U.S. dollar as the premier international reserve currency indefinitely. I mean, the current international crisis owes much to the imperfections of the current international financial system. And I think it would be a U.S. interest, as is very, very persuasively argued by Fred Bergson in a current article in Foreign Affairs, to actually promote the development of alternative reserve currencies to take the pressure off the dollar. And if the renminbi can become ultimately one of those reserve currency next to the euro, because those are the only three I can think of, dollar, euro, and renminbi for the longer term, so be it, and it would be a good thing for the U.S. So I would take a slightly different tack than the report does. I would actually take a very positive attitude towards what is going on and suggest that it is in U.S. interest to promote it. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter, and I appreciate you mentioning that what the report really was missing was an articulation of U.S. policy response. I think we talked about that in preparing the report, and what we started to do was prepare something that looked increasingly like a screed about fiscal discipline and improving competitiveness in domestic markets that would dwarf the subject matter of the report. So it became tricky. And we also hoped at that time that we'd have someone who'd really be able to address that issue in a conference such as this with Tim Adams. So, Tim, take it away.
Thank you. You couldn't find that person, so you invited me, and I appreciate being a part of this. You know, I have to say I agree with everything Peter just said, and I would also say it's an excellent report. I enjoyed reading it. It's a nice summation of the discussion that's occurring, and a discussion which I suspect will intensify over time and should intensify. I think we are somewhat intellectually rudderless in the multilateral organizations, where we're going in a post-Washington consensus world, and what is the appropriate role of exchange rates in the adjustment process. We saw just yesterday the World Bank chief economist, Justin Lin, noting that an appreciation in the RMB would have no effect or is not an important component to rebalancing Chinese growth. I think that's wrong, but I think it's important that we have a very robust debate. And I've encouraged the IMF and other institutions to try to foster that debate going forward. Let's just back up a minute and think about a little bit about history, and because I think it helps think about the future. You know, the papers today are full of stories about the fall of the Berlin Wall, and you think about where we were 20 years ago. At that time, it was with great fanfare that we welcomed in the East. There was a great sense of optimism about Central and Eastern Europe and Russia. Tiananmen was occurring, so there was pessimism about China. And Washington was in the grips of fears about Japan taking over the world. Japanese institutions. Banks were some of the largest institutions in the world. There were a number of them. And so it was Japan as the challenging power to U.S. hegemony, China embroiled in domestic politics, and the future in Eastern Central Europe and Russia. You know, fast forward today, and we see the Baltics suffering from declines in their growth of 18 or 19%. Russia gripped by oligarchs and still incredibly dependent on hydrocarbons and natural resources. Japan, unfortunately, suffering from deflation, demographic challenges, and slow growth. And, you know, the mighty Japan that was going to overtake the U.S. didn't. But China came out of that crisis like the phoenix and has proven to be a formidable opponent and challenger. And, of course, during that period of time in which the U.S. was dismissed as almost a second-rate power, we've grown in real terms by 75%. So I suspect 20 years from now, when we're back here hopefully having a similar discussion, I suspect that our assumptions about winners and losers over that period of time will probably have adjusted as well. It's always dangerous to take current trends and extrapolate them over a period of time. We should welcome, as Peter noted, a challenge to the dollar. I think competition is a good thing. We welcomed the euro, and there was an expectation that the euro would play a greater role in reserve accumulation since its inception. It has. I think it suffers from a number of challenges, which some are theoretical, some are practical. But it has taken a greater role, and it will. The role of the yen in reserves has diminished. And I suspect 20 or 30 years from now, the Chinese RMB will play a greater role in reserves. But they have to do the things that are noted in this paper, and they have to do the things that that Peter noted. Now, with respect to U.S. interests, let me hit four quick areas. One is we should welcome what the Chinese are doing or say they're going to do, right? The official pronouncements from the PBOC, from the State Council, from President Hu and Premier Nguyen, and all those pronouncements we're going to hear repeated over the next week as the President goes to APEC and then on to Beijing. All those pronouncements about what the Chinese plan on doing, what is official policy, we should embrace. It's absolutely in their interest to rebalance their economy, have a more flexible exchange rate, to open their capital account. It is in their interest. It will make China a more balanced, stable economy, and it is our interest that evolution actually occurs. So we should embrace and encourage the Chinese to actually do it even more quickly. Because as Melissa notes in the paper notes, the accumulation of reserves is still at a fairly rapid clip. The Chinese now have $2.273 trillion worth of reserves. They accumulated about $100 billion over the last 9 months, and close to $800 billion worth of U.S. treasuries. That process is not sustainable over the long haul, and they need to undertake the policies that free them from the grips of that policy regime. The second is we need to encourage the multilateral process, as I noted in the opening, to have a robust debate about what a post-Washington consensus world looks like. What is the role of exchange rates? What do we do about a world in which half of the countries are pegged to the dollar and the other half aren't? What is the role of the IMF in the 21st century as we think about the external adjustment process? How do we think about beggar-than-neighbor policies and competitive devaluations or adjustments? So we should support the multilateral process, whether it is the bank or the IMF or regional institutions. We should give our support to that process. Regional integration, you're going to hear a lot about regional integration on the President's trip. There is concern that there will be a fortress Asia. It's possible. I don't think we can stop Asian integration. I think what we should do is ensure that it's done in an open architecture way, that trade flows and capital flows are still welcome, that the U.S. continues to play both an economic and political role in both East and South and Southeast Asia. And I think that's the case. But we, the U.S., need to bring to the table at APEC and other forum new ideas about how we play a central role in that integration. And I hope that we'll hear new ideas as the President heads to Singapore. And then domestically, Charles noted that they didn't have room for the whole list of things that we need to do here, but the list is long, and it's relevant to the discussions we're having now on health care, on rebuilding our banking system, on the role of the Fed, on climate change. We can't necessarily control what the Chinese do or what the Europeans do, the Japanese, the IMF, but we can certainly control what we do. And right now we face numerous challenges. Our fiscal situation is absolutely abhorrent. The trend lines on spending and revenues is unsustainable and historically unsustainable. And I suspect at some point we're going to have a day of reckoning. Whether we're astute enough to do that prior to another crisis or not remains to be seen. But when you have spending at 25% of GDP and climbing, revenues at 15% of GDP and stable, and when you have entitlement programs that are about 7 or 8% of GDP and will double over the next 20 years, and entitlement programs which have enormous political support by voting blocks of people who actually vote, it is a recipe for long-term disaster. As you've all seen the deficit projections over the next 10 years, doubling from our debt-to-GDP ratio from 40 to 80%, maybe 100%. And that's with fairly modest assumptions about what interest rates look like over that time horizon. If you play with the interest rate assumptions, then those last years, the 10-year numbers, if you do a fan chart, you get some pretty sobering outcomes. As a friend of mine who was in town from Oslo a week ago asked, will the U.S. still be a developed country 10 years from now? You know, real concerns about our fiscal trajectory and our political will to deal with those challenges, especially as we debate a health care plan that will add $1 trillion to that budgetary outlook. But it's not just budget. It's the role of the central bank, the confidence we have in the Federal Reserve, and their objectives. That's an issue which is being debated today, next week, over the next couple of months. What is the objectives of the Fed? What is their mandate? And how much authority will they have in various schemes as we put in place a new financial regulatory regime? And there's other issues such as how we treat capital. An old boss of mine at Treasury used to say, capital's a coward. It goes where it's treated well, and it flees where it's treated badly. Will we treat capital well here? Will we tax it and regulate it in such a way that capital flees, or will we invite it here? Will we have a CFIUS process that invites foreign investment? Will we give visas to people who want to come here and invest in our assets? So there's a whole host of issues concerned capital formation and the flow of investment. Will we have an economy that's based on investment and savings, or one that continues to be based on consumption that exceeds our ability to generate the income? We have, for the last 25 years, lived beyond our means, and we've done it because we've been able to borrow from abroad, and we've done it with cheap and abundant credit. Credit is no longer cheap and abundant. And at some point, we're going to have to live within our means. Human capital. Will we have the workforce that allows us to compete in the 21st century? It sounds like a throwaway line, but it actually really is true. If you fill this room with 100 ninth graders, and you track their tenure over the following years, a third of them will never graduate from high school. Only half of those who graduate from high school would go to college. By the sophomore year of the 100, only 26 are still in college. And if you get to the fifth year of college, only 18 of them will graduate. And if they're Hispanic or African-American, the number is 9. 9 of 100. That is not a workforce of a world-class economy. So we have to think about and invest in human capital if we want to compete with China or with other fast-emerging economies. And lastly, we need to ensure that we're open to trade. Unfortunately, I think that our policy prescriptions for expanding trade has ground to a halt. I understand the politics behind it, and it's even more difficult when unemployment is 10.2% and rising. But the president has an opportunity on this trip to resuscitate the U.S.-Korea free trade agreement, to bring trade solutions to APEC and other Asia regional integration ideas, and reiterate this country's belief in open markets and trade expansion. We benefit from it. China benefits from it, as do other countries. But we cannot close off our borders and hope to be a prosperous country going forward And all this comes back to the role of the dollar. The dollar is just a reflection of relative fundamentals. You know, no one declared the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. It wasn't passed by a U.N. Security Council meeting. It wasn't an IMF meeting. It wasn't a G20 meeting where someone wrote a communique and said, today it's the dollar. It's 100 years worth of cumulative evolutionary change in which a series of accidents and shocks and mistakes in other places and the ascendancy of a U.S. economy allowed it to be that. And we benefit enormously from it. And I don't suspect that any other currency is going to be declared the reserve currency going forward, either the dominant, preeminent, or a major reserve currency. It is an evolutionary process. But we have the ability to control what we do in that evolutionary process. And if we make the right decisions today, next week, next month, next year, then confidence comes back, the global confidence comes back in our ability to manage our destiny. And as a result, the U.S. dollar will benefit. Thank you.
That was great, Tim. I appreciate your policy prescriptions. If we had actually attempted to do something like that in this work, we not only would have exceeded our mandate, I'm sure we would have been called in. I would have been called into my boss's office and said, wait a minute, we're pathologically nonpartisan here, advocating policy prescriptions which may or may not step with all members of our legislative and executive bodies. May not be a good idea, but I thought that was terrific. I want to say one more thing. To the extent that our report is perceived as a negative about China's China's policy actions, certainly wasn't intended to be so. One of the challenges that we have here, and I dare say both the gentlemen on the panel with Melissa have, is that we're called almost every day by someone on Wall Street when Wen Jiabao sneezes and they say, what does this mean for the value of the dollar? You know, so that the question is, you know, if there is this perception out there that what China is doing has negative impacts. There was a report which was a little nutty that came out that said that secretly the members of Middle Eastern and Chinese and Russian financial ministries had gotten together to talk about how they weren't going to use the dollar anymore as a settlement currency. And there's just a lot of paranoia out there. And it is largely, I think, misplaced, as certainly was our conclusion. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be using either the paranoia, and this is where I get in danger of providing a policy prescription. This is where we shouldn't use this as something to stimulate our thinking about how to improve our own lot in life. And challenges in general for the United States are good. We like competition. We embrace competition. So to the extent that China is going to be a metaphoric challenge, even if not a near-term challenge, is probably a good thing for policymakers. At least I hope so. Do we have questions? I really hope that we do. Of course we do. I knew Ernie would step up to the plate. We've got a mic coming in. Thanks, Ben.
Like it. Well,
could you identify yourself?
Ernie Prieg with Manufacturers Alliance. First, I want to agree with Tim Adams with his felicitous assessment of the international financial system as intellectually rudderless. And I'd like to just make two points to sort of broaden the analytic context and ask for responses from you that relate directly to what is the future role of the dollar or reserve currencies more broadly. And the first point is that we really have to have a clear fix on where is the exchange rate system going at this stage. My own assessment, but to make it a proposition, is that post the financial crises of the late 90s and then this one, 2009, we're heading, most of us are, toward market-oriented, lightly managed floating rates. That's the dollar and the European currencies, Canadian dollar, Mexican peso, even Japan and South Korea, most of the way there. And China, of course, is the big exception. But if that is where we're going, then this whole debate about reserve currencies changes because the reserve currencies in lightly managed floating rates plays a much, much smaller role. You have a floating currency, your adequate reserve level is zero. I think we really have to, before we talk about ahead, where are we going, and of course it focuses very much on China as the big exception by heavily managing what is generally seen as a undervalued rate, which brings me to my second point, which is more factual of recent trade than been analytical, and it's related to where are we going on the currency misalignment issue, if you will, which wasn't mentioned by any of the speakers. And if we come out, and very much related to undervalued Chinese currency, if we come out with this recovery with, again, a rapidly rising Chinese surplus and a rapidly rising U.S. deficit, this makes all these issues much, much larger. The U.S. will be faced rapidly growing foreign debt, which puts downward pressure on the dollar. The Chinese, what to do, buy or not to buy dollars. You don't want the dollar going down. So this is the real challenge that we should be looking at. And I just quote a recent China, week or two ago, a senior Chinese Ministry of Commerce official, I think the finance minister again in the G20 meeting, said there'll be no upward revision of the renminbi before there is noticeable improvement in our exports. And this is a report that I'm going to come out with next week because I'm waiting for the September U.S. trade figures Friday. From the first to the third, for manufacturing sector, 70% of merchandise trade is the one most deeply linked to exchange rates. For China, for the first three quarters, from the first quarter to the third quarter, manufactured exports are up 33%. Plus, from the second to the third quarter, which is the first quarter of recovery, their trade surplus in manufacturing is up, I believe it's $19 billion. I don't have the number with me, but that's big. The U.S., on the other hand, our exports are about, I don't have September yet, for the first 9 months, up 4%. And again, there's going to be a big jump in our trade deficit in manufacturers, which might come to a rule of thumb, a loss of 100,000, 200,000 jobs, incidentally, in the third quarter in the manufacturing sector. So we really have to pay a lot closer attention to where the heck this recovery is going. And if we're headed back toward export-led growth here, import of last resort there, import of last resort here, we've got much bigger questions more urgent questions to address on these issues of reserve currency. What do you do? So those are my 2 points. Any reactions would be appreciated.
Thank you for that collection of questions. What's the future role of the U.S. dollar? I'm not worried about it at all. I think the U.S. will always remain the largest or one of the largest economies, and as long as the U.S. remains a liberal political system and is an open economy, the U.S. dollar will remain a very important reserve currency. Even if, hypothetically, we were to move to an SDR-based system, because the SDR is ultimately based on other currencies, and the U.S. will remain the most important component of the SDR. So I'm not worried about that at all. So the I think the more fundamental long-term question is where is the world moving? Where are we moving on exchange rate systems, financial systems? And what do we do when in a mixed system, as we have at the present time, where the major currencies are floating, the euro, the dollar, the kroner, the Canadian and the Australian dollars, and so on, whereas fairly significant emerging market currencies are highly managed, like the Chinese currency. How do we get out of this sort of bifurcated, unstable system that we have at the present time? What lies ahead? Well, nobody knows. I think the chances that we will negotiate something internationally that everybody can agree upon is pretty remote. I mean, we had that in Bretton Woods, and even there was significant disagreement between what the British delegation proposed and what the American delegation ultimately succeeded in persuading the meetings to adopt. That's the fixed exchange rate, Bretton Woods system, which fell apart in 71 and was definitively replaced in 73. The chances that we will have another international level agreement of that kind, I just don't see it, quite frankly. The more probable evolutionary development of the system is that we will gravitate towards a multiple currency reserve system. And the most probable candidates for that are, of course, the U.S. dollar, the euro, and the renminbi. And the Japanese have never wanted the yen to circulate as a reserve currency for various reasons that I will not go into now. So these are the three big candidates. And but I'm worried not that the renminbi will become a reserve currency, but that the Chinese will stop short of allowing it to become a reserve currency, because then they will have to give up so much state control. What do we do about the misalignment of exchange rates? I'm not a champion of China's exchange rate policy, but in my own work, I have tended to emphasize that it is not nearly as important a question as people think it is. There are other factors that drive international trade flows that are, I think, more powerful than nominal exchange rates. In the case of China, I believe that the runaway export surplus since 72, 73 is much less a function of their continuing to peg the nominal exchange rate as it is of two other factors. A, the extremely explosive macroeconomic policies in the United States, both on the fiscal and on the monetary side, and the extremely fast productivity growth in manufacturing in China. Since they set in motion from the turn of the century very aggressive reform policies for the manufacturing sector, both the state part and the non-state part, productivity growth in manufacturing in China has been so fast they could never have compensated for that, is nominal exchange rate adjustment. If you're willing to buy into that line of thinking, the conclusion of that is, the implication of that is that the undervaluation of the Chinese currency, even though it may have been a deliberate intention of the Chinese state, was probably to some extent unavoidable, given the magnitude of the reforms that were taken place in China. So that casts a somewhat different perspective on the misalignment. They could never have compensated for the relative productivity gains in that decade. That's the period of maximum reform in China, which is now winding down. China is slowly becoming a more normal country with more normal problems. So that doesn't mean I support their current exchange rate policy. I think they would do the world and themselves a service by allowing a wider trading band, in other words, to flexibilize. But we should not be fooling ourselves to think that that would solve all problems. The underlying productivity differentials are the most important thing. And I completely agree with Tim Adams. It's almost embarrassing to the degree to which we agree. We didn't collude beforehand, but I think the emphasis should not be on the nominal exchange rate management, but on factors that influence productivity growth in the U.S., in the human resources sector, in energy, in so many other areas. We are falling behind, not because of the exchange rate, but because productivity growth has slowed down. And I think that's what we have to focus on. You can achieve international competitiveness by lowering your exchange rate or lowering your cost. And you lower your cost by becoming more efficient. And we haven't put enough emphasis on that. So I don't know what lies ahead. I don't believe that the Chinese are doing the right thing. But I think they're also hurting their own interests because it is slowing down the structural reforms that they, in speech after speech, advocate as their objectives, advertise as their objectives. And I think at some point they will have to flexibilize, or the real exchange rate will run away from them in terms of domestic inflation. They cannot control it forever. But I would like to urge you not to think of that as that is the pivotal international issue.
Just that on reserves, the IMF agrees with you. We've seen at the annual meetings in Istanbul an effort to try to focus on what is the optimal level of reserves, I think, for many countries. And reserves have increased globally, $5 or $6 trillion since 2001. Many of the key economies have far passed what is theoretically appropriate level of reserves. But what I've heard from the emerging markets is that process isn't going to stop. They see it as a way of self-insurance, and they don't want to have to rely on the IMF for funding. So, yes, I agree with you on reserves. I think the fund agrees and it is trying to show leadership on that issue. I don't suspect much is going to change for the foreseeable future.
Thank you, Carl Dahlman, Georgetown University. Thank you very much. An excellent panel on very important issues, and I think that the discussion is really very fruitful. I wanted just to pick up on something that Tim said, and I really agree with your analysis. And your third set of points is really about the big domestic challenges which are within our capability to be solved or respond. And the fourth is trade. And my concern is that given the difficulty of addressing a lot of those domestic things and the fact that the political system will tend to go towards easier solutions and blame scapegoat China, the trade stuff is going to get very tough. And so I'm wondering, and I would really encourage that we have more discussions of this. I mean, that's really the agenda, what we can control. And the agenda, as you pointed out, is really, you know, very, very challenging. And the difficulty is that in the current state of our economy, with the problems of the bailouts, the financial cost of that, the injection of liquidity into the system, the health care, the looming things that are coming there, it's very difficult to have the resources to invest in enhancing our productivity, which is Peter's saying. So I was wondering what positive things can be done to make this agenda more of a real broad-based agenda in the U.S., going across both parties, because in the end, that's what we really have to focus on, and we've been losing our predominance in the world because we've gotten fat and lazy. And so the question is, how can we bring the focus back to that, and how can we put that into the political system? Because any politician talks about these things, and they involve, you know, more sacrifice and more spending on something else, they get well out of office. And so how can we deal with that? And I was wondering, we can start the discussion, and I encourage the center to, you know, these are really critical things, and we need to get a handle on them. Thank you.
I completely agree with both your points, especially on trade. The tire case, the Chinese tire case, I think has started what is going to be a lengthy process of different industries using that particular trade law to bring cases against the Chinese. And I'm not talking about the merits of the case, whether the White House did the right thing or not, but what we've seen is steel pipes, we've seen paper, and I think what we're going to see is a proliferation of anti-China trade cases. Again, not about the merits, but there's a certain amount of the atmospherics that this relationship may have some rocky times ahead, especially as unemployment continues to rise and we go into the midterm elections. You're absolutely right. It is difficult to get away from this mentality where you can't have it all. You know, the great philosopher of our time, Oprah, says you can have it all, you just can't have it all at the same time. And we're not learning from that, right? We're telling – just think about health care. We're telling American people you can have – we're going to expand health care. You can have the health care you want, and someone else is going to pay for it. It's just trying to solve the equation in those three variables is just not possible. And we're papering over it by using a variety of budget gimmicks and employing other kinds of devices to get us through this healthcare debate. And I'm actually sympathetic to universal healthcare. I just think now is not the time. Now is the time to think about how we put our fiscal house in order and how we're going to pay for the things we've already promised instead of promising more. And I think we're going to have – I suspect that at some point the markets are going to send a very strong signal that what we're doing is not sustainable and that we'll have to take some very tough measures. But it remains to be seen whether this president or the president I worked for or the previous president is willing to go to the American people and say, look, this is the way it is. And there are tough times ahead, and we've lived beyond our means, and we have to take some very tough measures.
Just talk about the trade issue. I think it is absolutely critical. I agree with Tim that I don't think we're headed for a trade war with China, but what these trade cases do is they encourage parts of our government, certainly parts of the Chinese government, that are focused not necessarily on openness and encouraging the free flow of trade, but on more developing industrial policies which are perceived to benefit domestic participants to the exclusion or to the discrimination of international participants. And that's, I think, a very, very serious challenge. I really wish that the president would go when he's in Korea and say, we're going to get Korea done. But I gather that the economic and foreign policy folks within the administration made a serious push on that and were rebuffed because there were other different policy priorities which take precedence. And so it's really hard when you have these kind of iterative approaches to policymaking to have a holistic discussion even within one government as opposed to with the American people. So it's the good news, as I gather, we're going to get good news on TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, that may send a signal, frankly, to Korea that it doesn't count as much anymore, which may make things difficult in Asia anyway, but that's a longer conversation.
Bill Helke. I'm retired from the Federal Reserve and currently teaching at the University of Maryland. I thought this was an excellent report, written in part by one of my former students. And clearly, this panel has just made a number of excellent points. And I've been to a number of panels where they make excellent points, not quite as good as this one, but good ones. And what I'm left with is it's really great we got a lot of knowledge, but there's a difference between knowledge and ignorance, right? And I think there's nothing more frightful than ignorance in action. And we have this huge globalization shock. I still know people think people have their arms around it. Okay, and this globalization shock goes around development. India and China, they're huge. And India and China are going to have much greater productivity growth going forward, much greater productivity growth than everybody else. That means in real terms, our currency is going to appreciate. Okay, and the other point, I admit it creeped up on me as well as it has on everybody else, that Tim made is how big the economies have gotten that peg to the dollar. Okay, they're huge, right? So we're talking about reserve currencies, but to me, the problem is a lot like 71-73, okay? The problem is not the price of the currency, which I would differ from the people in the trade. The problem is China is setting the price, okay? And not only that, but we do not understand the implications of their setting the price. Okay, I just heard a brilliant guy from, I think, Standard Chartered Bank talk at the Peterson Institute, gave all these same pretty good facts that you guys gave, and I'd be giving him an A. Then what does he say? Well, China's got to worry about the inflation problem, so what are they going to do? They're going to tighten policy by raising their interest rate. Okay, but what does raising their interest rate do? They raise their interest rate relative to ours, capitals flow in. It's not a tightening of policy. It's a loosening of policy. Okay? And so you're going to have more inflation. If they don't allow inflation to happen through wages, it's going to happen through dollar asset prices. And that's what caused our problem going up in 2008 and down in the second half. You can just trace it to China raising rates, China lowering rates, and all the ramifications of it. So my point is, this is unstable, okay? And we all say, well, China doesn't have independent monetary policy. But not only China doesn't have independent monetary policy, we don't, okay? Because if they raise rates, where are they getting the dollars? They print them in the basement of the central bank? We're printing them. Why is that? Because of our operating mechanism? We set the price, supply all money and credit available at that price. So two things. Am I nuts? Is this just crazy analysis? And if I'm not, what are the prospects that we're not going to go through what we went through from 71-73, which was trying to do a bunch of revaluations, which obviously didn't work, and then float? Or are we going to use our heads, and are some of these people going to start floating now?
Hard to disagree with what you say. I think, like in the period 71-73, we are now living at the edge of a historical change in systems. The change in 71-73, I think, could be more quick and more abrupt because we moved from a fixed exchange rate system to a floating exchange rate system that became a dollar-based, not because anybody decreed that that should be the case, but because that's what the world wanted and the markets evolved into. The challenge now, I think, is more complicated because we essentially have a floating system and we see no way back to a fixed exchange rate system. We cannot go back to Bretton Woods. So we have to live with the current imperfect and, as you say, instable system, at least for a while. the best we can hope for is that within the context of the G20, I think there will be a meeting of the minds on what the problems are and in what way to seek to look for solutions. In my view, the Chinese currency is a pivotal element in this conundrum. If the Chinese can evolve into a more market-based exchange rate system, that would be good for them and good for the world, and in a way that would allow many of the other countries in East Asia or emerging market economies to adopt a more market-related system themselves. That does not mean that I am philosophically or intellectually enthralled by a floating exchange rate system. I believe ideally it would be better if we could go back to a fixed exchange rate system, but I see no avenue to that at all. So we have to make the best of the mess we are in. And if the Chinese can move, that would be significant. It's a miracle that the Chinese have in fact been able to do what they are doing so long. Even Alan Greenspan, when he visited China in the early part of this decade, predicted that they would not be able to maintain that double peg. We are focused on the one peg, the nominal peg, but the Chinese had in fact a double peg. Because of their massive domestic sterilization, they also controlled the real exchange rate by avoiding domestic inflation, which might otherwise have solved the problem. They didn't do that. And this is the first case in history that I'm aware of where a major country controls both the nominal and the real exchange rate. Nobody thought that possible. Of course, we end up with a balance sheet of China's central bank that is rather screwy at the moment. They're the largest issuers of bills, of bonds-type financial instruments in the Chinese economy. I don't know of no other central bank that has operated in a similar way. Sooner or later, that system will have to come to an end. And I think it would be in the interest of the Chinese to allow for nominal exchange rate flexibilization, not seek the solution in allowing domestic inflation to solve the problem. Because in the Chinese situation, there's so much a bomb of liquidity hanging over the system in the form of an M2 GDP ratio, which is now approaching, 180% or something like that. So you have to be very worried in China about inflation expectations in those circumstances. And for that reason, it would be far better if the Chinese were to begin to flexibilize the nominal exchange rate, initially by broadening the trading band, and then ultimately move to a more floating system, which probably, even in the best of circumstances, lies at least 5 or 10 years into the future. But the Chinese hold the key, I think, to make the evolution of the international adjustment processes in a more orderly way. And they're not doing, I believe, what they should be doing at this point in time.